Getting back into it. Once again, just a reminder, check out barrierlakesolidarity.org. Sign the petition in support, or send a message in support of the Algonquins of Barrier Lake, and asking the Quebec government and others in industry to stop clear-cutting their land. Some exciting news. Finally, the Tekwanaki newspaper is available online. Very good news. Tekanews.com. And you can check out the Teka. Teka's put together out of six nations. And you can read the whole thing online. Canada's oldest native weekly. Two voices, six nations, and the Mississaugas of the New Credit. I mean, this article looks at the historic Great Law recital in August. Looks at the Dundalk Sludge Walk. Talks about talks about their sports down at Six Nations and across Haudenosaunee territory. Just good news. It's finally available online. We're going to be reading more articles from Tekanews.com as the website gets developed and we're into it a little more. I'd also suggest getting a subscription. It's super cheap. Dufferin Aggregates faces public over pit concerns. And this is something the Tech is going to be covering if Dufferin Aggregates does not act a little more carefully in their actions. This is posted on July 5th. Dufferin Aggregates plan to open a 648-hectare sand and gravel pit in the small community of Paris, Ontario, was met with stiff community resistance during a public meeting attended by nearly 100 residents. It marked the second time the company had met with members of the community over the past 3 months. Basically, they had no real answers. Dufferin kept talking about how, well, the ministry sets rules. We can't, we don't have to be any better than what the ministry sets. They didn't really seem to care about the concerns. Mark, noticing that it's just, it's just progress in your community. Well, the Tech is going to be covering this soon, I assume, because, well, this land, the 640, this is a mega quarry. This is a mega quarry in Paris, Ontario, right on the Grand River. This is Six Nations land. This is Haldimand Tract. Dufferin better get their act together and communicate with the HDI, the Haudenosaunee Development Institute, at the very least, of their plan, because this will get shut down. A mega quarry on the Grand River without consultation of the Six Nations. Consultation of the community, one thing. Consultation of Six Nations, it's a whole other. And the community saying no. So what do you think Six Nations is going to say? Speaking of saying no, on Saturday, July 7th, a ceremony and celebration took place on the North Vancouver shores of Burrard Inlet that will help define politics in British Columbia for years to come. It was a calm, sunny summer day that saw the Tsleil-Waututh First Nation, the people of the inlet, and the Squamish Nation sign the Save the Fraser Declaration. This was posted on July 10th on Rabble.ca by Derek O'Keefe. Now signed by well over 100 bands and chiefs, the declaration is a clear and eloquent statement of Indigenous opposition to the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline, and in fact, to all new proposed projects that seek to export more bitumen from Alberta's tar sands. This drive for more tar sands exports across BC includes the proposed expansion of the Kinder Morgan Pipeline, with its terminal on Burrard Inlet behind Burnaby Mountain. Kinder Morgan, a massive Texas-based energy corporation, has quietly been expanding exports of bitumen through tankers out of Vancouver's narrow harbor. Now, Kinder Morgan has ambitious expansion plans that involve twinning the pipeline and a huge increase in the number of tankers in the inlet. The signing by the Tsleil-Waututh and the Squamish represents the extension of a powerful wall of opposition from First Nations, now stretching from northern to southern BC. Joined as well by other impacted Indigenous peoples in northern Alberta and Northwest Territories, the declaration was initiated in 2010 by the Yinka Dene Alliance, which consists of Six Nations. The July 7th signing took place on Tsleil-Waututh land, directly across from the waters from the Kinder Morgan Terminal. Tsleil-Waututh Ceremonial Sundance Chief Reuben George explained that this day was a celebration, a long time in the making. Quote, "We gave an opening to the celebration of the Save the Fraser Declaration back in December 2011. And we said then that we want that we intended to sign and honor the Yinka Dene in our traditional ways on our territory, unquote. This steadfast and broad First Nations opposition to tar sands exports across BC and out via the Pacific coast is far from alone. They are joined by concerned local communities and the myriad of organizations and groups motivated by values of environmentalism and social justice. So, like it or not, and it's clear that the big oil companies and their friends in the government don't like it, these issues will be fundamental in the provincial election which is coming down the pipeline in the next year. Christy Clark, whose approval ratings are floundering and whose party trails the NDP badly in the polls, has of late been trying to stay out of the fray about Enbridge. So last week, opposition leader Adrienne Dix called her out. In an opinion piece first published in The Tie, Dix called Clark absent without leave on the issue, noting that her government had in fact failed to submit anything to the National Energy Board's joint review panel, unlike the NDP and the government of Alberta and Canada, who have all made official submissions. Dix then assailed the Premier for her confusing and contradictory earlier comments about Enbridge. Premier Clark has refused to take a position on the pipeline, even though she has admitted that, to her own words, BC is taking 100% of the risks, yet gets about the same benefit as Nova Scotia. At the same time, the Premier has stated she is pro-pipeline. What a confusing person. At the time of the publication, Clark has issued no rebuttal. Meanwhile, John Cummins, leader of the upstart right-wing Conservative Party, has expressed his support for the Enbridge pipeline. It seems an odd stance for someone who made his name on issues to do with BC wild salmon fishery, given the risk to fish stocks by pipeline or tanker spills. It could be that he's a Conservative douche under the spell of Harper. So the electoral battle lines in BC are being drawn by the proposed pipeline routes and the opposition they have provoked. But it's much bigger than a vote, and much bigger than just these particular pipelines. The debate around Enbridge and Kinder Morgan is actually a debate what direction BC and Canada will take over the next generation, and about how or if there will be a restitution and justice for the First Nations of this land. To understand what's really at stake, we can look back 45 years to the words of Chief Dan George, grandfather of Reuben George, and the current Chief Justin George, an important Tsleil-Waututh leader who gained global notoriety after acting in Hollywood films late in his life. Chief George was nominated for an Academy Award for his role in Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman. But his most important ever appearance on stage may have been a presentation he delivered at a Centennial Canada Day event at the Old Empire Stadium in Vancouver, just across the water from the Save the Fraser signing. On July 1, 1967, Chief Dan George gave an impassioned soliloquy that was part lament and part prophecy. He began by denouncing the history of colonialism in Canada. Quote, "When I fought to protect my land and my home, I was called a savage. When I neither understood nor welcomed his way of life, I was called lazy. When I tried to rule my people, I was stripped of my authority." Unquote. Chief Dan George ended his remarks with a call to action and a hopeful prediction. Quote, "O God, like the thunderbird of old, I shall rise again out of the sea and build my race into the proudest segment of your society. So shall we shatter the barriers of our isolation, so the next 100 years be the greatest in the proud history of our tribes and nations." Unquote. In their struggle to defend their land and their waters against the multinational corporations like Enbridge and Kinder Morgan, the First Nations are not alone. Their isolation has been shattered. For the sake of our collective future, we all owe them our unyielding support in their effort to stop the expansion of the tar sands. And you can check that out in rabble.ca again. Posted by Derek O'Keefe, it is the Tsleil-Waututh and the Squamish make wall of opposition to tar sands pipelines even stronger. And speaking of the Enbridge Corporation, Enbridge is a very bad week. What was the best news for the pipeline debate this week from rabble.ca? Enbridge has had a bad week, a very bad week. First, the Tsleil-Waututh and Squamish signed on to oppose all tar sands exports across BC. Then there was a scathing report about the company's handling of the 2010 oil spill in Michigan. We talked about that on Grand River Radical Radio a couple weeks ago, Kalamazoo. This was followed up by a series of comments from political leaders and civil society groups against their proposed pipeline from Alberta's tar sands to the BC coast. What was the worst news this week for Enbridge? Or in other words, what was the best news in the ongoing effort to stop the pipeline from ever being built? Number one, the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board likening Enbridge's handling of the Michigan spill to the Keystone Cops. You may only recognize that if you're of a generation older than 35-year-old people. Federal NDP leader Thomas Mulclair slamming Enbridge and saying it's time to pull the plug on the proposed pipeline. That's a big call by Thomas Mulclair in the federal NDP. More than 50 organizations in Alberta calling for a new pipeline safety review. That's a pretty big hit. Is that the one we're picking? I don't know. Oh, here's a big one. The Tsleil-Waututh and the Squamish First Nation signing on to save the Fraser Declaration opposing the tar sands pipelines. Or, none of the above will have any impact. Harper and Enbridge are determined that this pipeline will get built. Well, it doesn't matter, Harper. That's the end of the selection. I'm picking number four. And I have to respond to this as none will have any impact. It's going to be stopped. It's going to get stopped out west. It's going to get stopped in the east. Line 9 will not happen. The Line 9 reversal will not happen. And there it is. Carrying forward here on AWOL Radio, 100.3 Sound FM, a true warrior beaten to death trying to protect his wife. Horrible news from Midland, Ontario. Tears come easily to friends and family who gathered near a downtown restaurant on Monday to remember a well-known Native leader killed while defending his wife. Andrew McSimong, 59, lived in Midland with his wife Lorraine, but remained close to his roots, serving as president of the Georgian Bay Native Friendship Center. On Friday evening, as was his custom, McSimong went to meet his wife who had just finished her shift at a local eatery. Police say they were dispatched to a disturbance outside the eatery, where a woman was apparently being harassed by two men upset that they couldn't be served since it was closed for the day. Wayne McSimong said his older brother intervened and things continued to escalate, resulting in Andrew McSimong being beaten to death. Quote, my brother showed me he was a true warrior. My people would call him a gigada, a true warrior. He really loved Lorraine so much. They had been together for 10 to 15 years, and he died protecting her. Unquote. Following the altercation, McSimong was rushed to Georgian Bay General Hospital, where he succumbed to his injuries. Police are not releasing results of a post-mortem examination until later. Midland Police Ron Wilden said McSimong touched a lot of lives through town with his generous, gregarious nature. A makeshift memorial flower, sympathy cards, hoping for a safe journey to the spirit world, and coffee cups recognizing Andrew McSimong's love of Java had been established in front of Dino's Fresh Food Deli, where Lorraine worked. Many choked back tears as they hugged and remembered the man affectionately known as Fudd, moniker related to McSimong's physical stature that some say resembled Elmer Fudd and his always sunny and optimistic disposition. We're just devastated, said Wayne McSimong, as he greeted a steady stream of well-wishers. It's just so senseless. Two men have been arrested, Jesse Richard Hrlichka and Paul Thomas McClung, both 26, from Midland. Very devastating news. Following up with the story, I told you we'd get an explanation of what happened in Paraguay. A couple weeks ago, after we had someone write an explanation that I could read on the radio, well, here it is, from Don Paley of DominionPaper.ca. Express coup rattles Paraguay. Transnational corporations, including Canada's Rio Tinto Alcan, undeterred by political turmoil. Posted July 9th. A coup snuck up on South America last month, taking people around the world by surprise. The June 22nd ouster of President Fernando Lugo Mendez and his replacement by Frederico Franco, head of the right-wing Paraguayan Liberal Party, took place without heavy police or military repression. The Economist called the coup, quote, a constitutional impeachment. There is no doubt that when he left office on June 22nd, Lugo bowed to the pressure of the Paraguayan Senate. While several governments in South America indicated they would not recognize the coup government, Canada and the U.S. immediately acknowledged the incoming regime. Quote, Canada notes that Fernando Lugo has accepted the decision of the Paraguayan Senate to impeach him and that a new president, Frederico Franco, has been sworn in. Diane Albonsky of the Canada's Ministry of State and Foreign Affairs said following the coup. Lugo's final statement as president indicated he would submit to the request of the Senate and step down. Initially, he did not call for his supporters to take to the streets, and in fact, through his words, demobilized the Paraguayan people. Following the coup, however, Lugo stated that what happened was indeed a coup and that he had been removed from office in the same style as Manuel Zelaya was removed in Honduras. Quote, here there was a rupture of the democratic order. Here there was a political trial without any reason and a parliamentary coup was carried out. There are various names, an express coup. Cristina Kirchner, president of Argentina, mentioned that it was a soft coup. Lugo said during a radio interview a week after the coup, quote, the laboratory for all of this was 3 years ago in Honduras, and here in Paraguay, it was perfected. Unlike in the case of Zelaya, who was removed in Honduras to Costa Rica by Honduran soldiers, Lugo continues to reside in Asunción, Paraguay's capital, now in the thick of a winter. Asunción is cold, rainy, and gray, and the level of mobilization is far lower than it was in Zelaya's ouster in Honduras. Even before the coup took place in Paraguay, tensions were mounting. Lugo's removal as president came after calls for his resignation on the heels of a massacre in the Curigate region in the east of the capital, in which at least 17 people were killed, including 6 pigs and 11 peasants. It was the first peasant massacre in Paraguay since the country's return to democracy in 1989. The Campesino movement in Paraguay are the most important social movement in the country, which is a little larger in size than the province of Newfoundland, or the island of Newfoundland. With a population of just over 6.5 million, the context of struggles around the land, and in particular the events in Curigate in June of great importance in order to properly understand the coup. Quote, in Paraguay, there are between 9 and 11 million hectares of land that we call wrongly granted land, or tierras mal habidas, which are lands that were granted in a fraudulent manner during the Stroessner dictatorship from 1954 to 1989 to children of the dictator, relatives of the dictator, business people from the region, even to other dictators like Somoza and to members of the Uruguayan military, said Abel Enrique Arala, a researcher with the Paraguay Peace and Justice Service, who spoke to the Dominion from Asunción, Paraguay. The June 15th massacre took place at Yvpiata, an area that is classified as having been misgranted during the dictatorship and where peasant movement had organized occupations of at least 4 mines. At the time of the massacre, those who were occupying the lands were not connected to the larger peasant movement. They were called to participate by supporters of the Liberal Party, of which Franco is part. Following the massacre, press reports indicated that the police were killed by sharpshooters, but according to Irala, the only weapons found in the peasant camp at Yvpiata were machetes and homemade shotguns. Quote, the occupation was not carried out in the framework of the peasant movement or with the knowledge of support of any Paraguayan national or regional peasant organization, said Irala. The day after the massacre, Irala traveled with a delegation of activists and journalists to Curigate, where he said local Liberal Party bosses were already calling for Lugo's resignation and the promotion of Franco to the presidency. Quote, the next day, when he did the evaluation of what he saw, one of the things that really caught our attention was the relation between the political parties in the area and the call specifically for Lugo to resign and be replaced by Federico Franco, said Irala. Continuing, what we didn't imagine is that those speeches, made 170 kilometers from here, coming from what seemed like local party members, would end up in a hearing 7 days later with the political trial of Lugo and Federico Franco staying on as president. Since Franco took power, the commission entrusted to investigate the events in Yvpiata has been cancelled. In Paraguay, there have been actions to protest the coup, including a week-long occupation of the state-owned TV station by its workers, demonstrations in the capital, and international protests along with supporters in Paraguay's border areas with Brazil and Argentina. However, the overall level of social mobilization since the coup has been low. Paraguay was the last country in the region to break with a two-party system with the election of Lugo, considered a progressive president in 2008. Quote, since 2008, a sector of the best social movement leaders transformed into bureaucrats and took up residence in the capital, convinced that this was the path to gain more force, wrote Raul Zabici, a Uruguayan journalist and analyst following the coup, continuing, "Today, with some exceptions, the movement are the weakest they have been in decades," unquote. Though considered progressive, Lugo's government passed anti-terrorist legislation and declared a state of emergency across a number of departments with a high level of peasant organization, once in 2010 and again in 2011. His government used repression to discourage peasant organizing with land occupations and has maintained a close relationship, especially with regards to intelligence sharing, with the U.S. government under the umbrella of anti-narcotic initiatives. Paraguayan analysts and writers have also commented on the appearance of ghost guerrilla movement, the Paraguayan People's Army, or the EPP, which they say has been used by the government to justify increasingly repressive tactics, including the use of Colombia-trained special forces against the peasant movement. Quote, "The fall of Lugo, as in every political crisis, exposes the change that are being produced in the region since Barack Obama defined the United States' new defense strategy," wrote Zubici. "Since Franco was named president, he has agreed to reinitiate negotiations with Montreal-based Rio Tinto Alcan and has sat down to meet with various local, national, and international representatives of transnational capital." Quote, "One can announce that Franco has already met with regional, national, and international business people who represent transnational power," said Irala, continuing, "While Rio Tinto Alcan represents the biggest Canadian interest in Paraguay, it is far from the only one." Bilateral merchandise trade between Canada and Paraguay last year was valued at more than $25 million. Quote, "Canadian companies looking into the Paraguayan marketplace may find opportunities in oil and gas, mining and infrastructure sectors, according to the Government of Canada. Paraguay is also a participant in the Canadian military training through the Pearson Peacekeeping Center." Don Paley is a freelance journalist and co-founder of the Vancouver Media Co-op. You can check that out on dominionpaper.ca/articles/4535, Express Coup in Paraguay. For a more detailed analysis of this coup, check out halifax.mediacoop.ca, a post by Steve Keynes called "Paraguay's Parliamentary Coup and Ottawa's Imperial Response" by Todd Gordon and Jeffrey R. Weber, also posted on socialistproject.org. Moving into a song, "Defend the Land," Tribe Called Red, NDNs from All Directions. Just them one.
watch them come for this stress. How about them make me tell on a this? Wanna make sure I got down a bulletproof vest. Cause when me pop up on a flirt, anything we come for this, me say them gone on the ground, figure rest. Make me tell you about scalp them and hang them up high. Scalp them and hang them up high. Scalp them and hang them up high. Me have to scalp them and hang them up high. Indian from all direction, surround the world of them in a Grand Canyon. Nez Perce, Cherokee and Cheyenne. Caps are outlaw raiders and bounty killer gang. Him a man, a pity wild Indian. Me take the money and the gold and burn the wagon. Rush up and wait, and the one leave. And the Calvary fill me from them one by one. And the rest of them me have under detention. Tell them that a party run the western land. Me have to scalp them and hang them up high. Scalp them and hang them up high. Scalp them and hang them up high. Me have to scalp them. Yeah, you're my
All right, and we continue on with the AOL radio here on 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS 100.3 on the FM dial, soundfm.ca. Check out AOL radio on the web, Rabble Podcast Network, rabble.ca/podcast, and on peaceculture.org. And we're going to Spain, where increased resistance to the extractive industry continues. And here we are. This piece is from aljazeera.com. Spanish miners dig in for prolonged protest. We're also going to be playing a short documentary piece that I'll be translating as we go from Spanish. Hopefully we'll be playing that on AWOL Radio, on CKMS a few times next week, as it's a very important note that, the austerity protesters occupy Madrid in a struggle for the working class after marches ended in violence yesterday.
Violence flared on the streets of Madrid in isolated clashes between police and demonstrators. Stones, bottles, and firecrackers were hurled at armed officers who responded with rubber bullets. Spanish newspapers later reported that 76 people had been injured. Most suffered cuts and bruises. One retired miner was hit by a baton round and was taken to hospital.
The atmosphere here now is extremely tense. The riot police are on standby as the demonstrators wait to hear the speeches. At the moment there's a standoff, but there have been confrontations in the past between armed officers and protesters.
The Spanish Prime Minister performed a massive U-turn on taxes. The people here know his hand is being forced by other European leaders, but they still blame Mariano Rajoy. The timing could not have been worse for a politician. He could almost hear the chants of demonstrators as he confronted Parliament.
We haven't got a freedom to choose. The circumstances are not that generous, and the only choice we've got is to accept these sacrifices, to give up some things, or otherwise to give it all up. The only question which should be asked, will these reductions help? My answer is yes, they will.
The increase in sales tax, something that Rajoy said he would never do, will hit the poor hardest. And there's more pain to come. Later retirement, cuts in education and health, as well as privatizations to try to boost the economy. Not everyone shares the Prime Minister's optimism that the measures will work.
It is the biggest injustice carried out in this country against the working class, carrying out these cuts the government wants. I believe it is more important in these times to support workers, miners in this case, with government subsidies, than helping bankers as they are.
Later, isolated skirmishes took place. Protesters hurled stones and fireworks. Police responded with plastic bullets. There were a number of injuries. Almost every sector is affected here. The latest involves groups of often elderly investors who may lose the value of shares in regional Spanish banks under the EU bailout terms. Tim Friend, Al Jazeera, Madrid.
And we're back here on AWOL Radio. It was from Al Jazeera, obviously. We'll play the second video, which I will translate You can check this out, Spanish Miners Battle Police Over Austerity. I'm chanting, my shirt is red. With blood from a fellow worker. Spanish miners in the northwest provinces of Asturias and Leon, armed with homemade rockets and slingshots, have been battling police in protests against the government cuts, including a slashing of subsidies in the industry. This is our last chance, it says. The video is showing that the government has failed to honor the mining plan in every way possible, says another masked miner, as they take over train tracks and occupy buildings. We don't want this. It's them who want this. There's a lot of money for other sectors, but not 4 euros to defend the coal. There is money for this. There is money to rescue the banks. We're humble workers. We only want to defend our rights, they say. Now we're facing a war against us. I just want to tell you that we're not terrorists. We fight for our bread. In the video, it's the police shooting rockets, shooting smoke grenades. There's a lot of tension, another one says. It has driven riot police into the cities, into the villages. The video is showing cops just attacking people. Villages with women and children, this protester continues. They just don't care, the police. They just don't care. We shouldn't have to wait for something bad to happen before finding a democratic solution, another one says. Recalling an instance with the police. They just charge at us brutally. Another one says, we could be having a dialogue, but they don't want to. Another one just says, we want to defend our jobs. We will fight to the end in any way we can. While firing homemade rockets and slingshots at the police to defend themselves. And they say, we're here. We're here fighting for our jobs in the region. We don't get anything with a peaceful demonstration, they say. Yes, they close the roads, they escort you. But after 2 hours, the permission is over. And then what? Nothing. If they wanted to negotiate, they wouldn't have sent 300 more policemen to join the already 1,000 already deployed. They just don't care. But we can be like them. One day something bad will happen. They're brave, but we're also brave. They're coming. Get them, they shout. The women in the village are shouting. Defend us. Get them. Get the police. Shooting homemade rockets. Little tubes. Metal tubes. Steel tubes. Social and working conditions are horrible with the labor law reform. They're working as a unit here. Firing rockets. Firing homemade rockets. Who voted for the healthcare cuts? Now it's 1 euro. The retired who paid taxes for years have to pay for medicines now. It's a dictatorship in disguise. They lie to us as if we're stupid, says another worker. Here, put the shield in. They're building amazing shields with homemade rockets to defend themselves. Defend themselves against the police who are just shooting indiscriminately. They didn't start this, they say the policemen did. They didn't start the violence. And we can see in this video, very well organized Spanish miners. Other sectors, healthcare, public service, I want to tell them to be brave. Join us, he says. Join the miners. And we see many people supporting them. To other workers who are precarious, who are being fired, says another worker. Go out and defend what is yours. Go out and defend what is yours. Why don't they fight against these policies, another one asks. Why don't they fight? We're all in the same boat. We all receive dismissal letters. We need to rise. We need to react. We need to go. We need to do. Come join us. We can't fight against this capitalism on our own. We need everyone.
Está claro que los
políticos obviously politicians
se must realize que vamos a luchar hasta el final.
They must realize that thousands, hundreds of thousands marching won't stop, that they're going to keep going. And again, Spanish miners continue the fight over austerity, joining those in Greece. Finally, on AWOL Radio, this part of the show, we have a plea from Paul Watson. Save our skipper, a little SOS. Dear friend of Sea Shepherd, I need your help. I've been under arrest and held in Germany for 2 months, and there is 1 month to go before my impending extradition request may be granted to Costa Rica. This is the second day of action that has been planned since my arrest on May 13th. A visual petition happening on July 20th is being planned and happening. You can check out seashepherd.org for more. If extradited, I could be held in a Costa Rican prison for up to 1 year before being granted trial. During that time, the $25,000 bounty on my head by the Shark Fin Mafia may be carried out. This is a serious situation and my safety cannot be guaranteed, no matter what the assurances I receive from the government of Costa Rica. Second to drugs, the shark fin industry generates the most money on the black market. The poachers who are claiming these bogus charges would love the Sea Shepherd to stop what they're doing and have the millions to lose in illicit profits. But the price our oceans and our future will pay if sharks are driven to extinction will be much, much greater. This case is politically motivated, and the German minister has the power to have me immediately released. Your help is needed to fight the extradition proceedings and secure my release. Paul Watson urges you to write to the German officials in power and reiterate what Interpol has already said. This case is politically motivated and should be dismissed. Speak out, write to German officials, join our visual petition, and participate in the day of action for our oceans and the future. Captain Paul Watson, founder and president of the Sea Shepherd Society. Check out seashepherd.org for more information on that.